Hello, welcome to this podcast from Science Progress. My name is Jonathan Moreno. I'm editor-in-chief of Science Progress, which is a project of the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C., and I'm here today with Paul Lombardo, who is a law professor at Georgia State University. Paul has just published a book, Three Generations, No Imbeciles, and we're going to be talking about that book today and its implication for modern progressivism. Full disclosure, I was a colleague of Paul's for 10 years at the University of Virginia while Paul was finally putting the finishing touches on this book after much nudging from me and his other friends and colleagues. And it is a great book. It's a very important book, particularly as we in America enter a new period, we hope, of progressive social policy. And there's so much to be learned from Three Generations, No Imbeciles, and much to be learned also about Paul's quiet activism in light of the historical and legal work that he's done. So, Paul, welcome to this podcast and Science Progress.
Thank you, Jonathan.
And it always seems to me that the case that is the basis of the book, namely the case of Carrie Buck, is in the pantheon of medical ethics and indeed in the history of American culture, but sort of like the Tuskegee syphilis study. A lot of people think they know about it and understand it, but really don't. And actually, in the case of Carrie Buck, perhaps she's unfortunately been lost in the mists of time. Could you explain to us, first of all, of course, who Carrie Buck was and why her 1927 Supreme Court case about her sterilization was and continues to be important?
Well, Carrie Buck was a girl from Charlottesville, Virginia. She was about 17 at the time this case started. She had been chosen as a resident of the Virginia Colony for the Epileptic and the Feeble-Minded in Lynchburg, which is about 50 miles south of Charlottesville. She'd been sent there when she was taken out of her home because she was pregnant and she wasn't married. She was basically an unwed mother. Many girls like Carrie were sent to the colony because they were supposedly people possessed of hereditary defects, moral degeneracy, they called it. So Carrie became, unfortunately for her, the subject of very bad timing. The state of Virginia had just passed a law in 1924 that would allow for sexual sterilization of people with hereditary defects. Mm-hmm. She was at the colony. Her mother had already been committed to the colony several years earlier. And she had a baby that people looked at and said there was something strange about the baby, too. So this became looked like a pattern. It looked like there was some kind of hereditary anomaly that was passed down through the generations. Mm. So Carrie becomes the person chosen to test the Virginia law by the people who wrote it. They wanted to take a case through the courts to demonstrate that the law was constitutional. And Carrie is the person who eventually ends up as the named party in the lawsuit of Buck versus Bell, Bell being the doctor at the Virginia colony who eventually sterilizes her. Mm-hmm. And the case becomes famous only after Oliver Wendell Holmes, at that time the most famous judge in the country, maybe in the world, yes, writes an opinion describing Carrie, her mother, and her daughter as three generations of imbeciles. And Holmes says, and ending his very brief and pointed opinion, three generations of imbeciles are enough.
And that was, of course, a majority opinion with one dissent, with no content to the dissent. Is that right?
Correct. It was an 8-1 decision. The only dissenter was a man named Pierce Butler, a somewhat obscure justice, and he left no opinion, so we're not exactly sure why he dissented.
And this case was obviously taking place in the context of a social and scientific movement that we know as eugenics. Isn't that right?
Correct. The eugenics movement had really picked up a lot of steam from about the first decade of the 20th century when it was introduced to America by scientists. People like Charles Davenport, who ran the Eugenics Record Office in Long Island. Davenport had been a scholar. He studied at Harvard. He taught there and at the University of Chicago, and he was the recipient of a fair amount of what today we would call grant money from the Harriman Foundation and later the Carnegie and the Rockefeller Foundations to set up a place called the Eugenics Record Office, which would study heredity. And it was that office that really brought the whole idea of eugenics as the science of good breeding into the public eye, along with other groups like the Racial Betterment Foundation of Battle Creek, run by Dr. Kellogg, and groups
such as that. Of Kellogg's fame, the Kellogg cereal fame.
Same family, correct.
Right. And these this biological philosophy also was reduced to law in a number of states, including Virginia.
Yes, the first laws were really developed as late as the or as early as the late 19th century to prevent marriages among people who were feeble-minded or people who had epilepsy. And then the first sterilization law, which was the next step, marriages don't always prevent births. So preventing somebody from actually having a child first occurred in Indiana in 1907. The first sterilization law was passed. And between 1907 and 1924, the time of the law that was tested in the Buck case, there were another dozen or so states that passed laws. But Buck was the one that cast a national and really international light on this process because it's the one that the Supreme Court endorsed, again, by an 8-1 decision.
And we should point out that, these diagnoses of feeble-mindedness, for example, or the notion of hereditary drunkenness or heritable excessive sexual pathology have all been debunked by more recent science. Is that right?
Pretty generally, I think that the length of the list that the people in the Buck case focused on was extraordinary, and it included people who were orphans, people who were criminals, people who were in any way possessed of chronic diseases, drunkards, ne'er-do-wells, and the poor.
So rich drunkards and rich ne'er-do-wells probably weren't sterilized in these systems.
This tended to be a pretty clear class distinction here. If people could afford a lawyer to fight these things, they didn't get sterilized, even when the laws were on the books.
And when we teach about eugenics, we tend to talk about both negative eugenics and positive eugenics. And positive eugenics is actually, once in a while, it surfaces again. Wasn't it about 20 years ago that the leadership in Singapore advocated that only rich people should marry and have babies?
Well, certainly, the Singapore law was a tax incentive for giving tax credits to the people who were employed and paying taxes and not giving tax credits to other people. And the assumption was that if you got a tax credit for children and you were working, that was a good thing.
Yeah. So in a sort of gross way, this positive eugenics notion is still very contemporary. And, of course, the darkest results of the eugenics movement in the United States manifested themselves in both positive but also negative eugenics of the Holocaust. Can you explain the, I don't think many Americans really understand the role of the priority that American eugenics had in influencing Nazi biological philosophy. Could you explain that?
Well, there's the deciding which is the chicken and which is the egg is often difficult, but in this case you've got two things going on at the same time. The Germans, as far back as the Weimar Republic and even into the 19th century, were very interested in studying heredity and had some of the first scientists who did so. And they were also interested in this new idea of eugenics very early on, the first decade of the 20th century. They and their American counterparts, scientists with this kind of interest, were in touch from really 1900 on. But America led the way in the law. Mm-hmm. America passed the first sterilization laws, as we've said, passed the stronger laws, also in 1924, prohibiting immigration on the basis of ethnicity, and that was certainly eugenics law as well.
Yeah.
And then eventually went on to pass other laws or to change other laws and put a scientific spin on the old anti-miscegenation laws that prohibited people of different races from being married. So in that sense, America was first, and the Germans paid attention to those laws and eventually actually gave an honorary degree to Harry Laughlin, the man who wrote the Model Sterilization Act, which was the basis for the Virginia law. It's pretty clear that the German scientist who stood at Hitler's elbow knew all about eugenics and certainly knew all about the genetics as well, but looked to America for precedents that they could rely on and justify some of their own activities.
And they, at one point, they were even concerned, as I recall, that Americans were getting ahead of them with respect to purifying the race.
Yes. Well, Hitler writes in Mein Kampf that the German law on immigration, for example, is really silly. They let anybody in at all,
mm-hmm.
and that America is leading the way there. Mm-hmm. So that's early in the 1920s, and then later on, when sterilization laws are in effect, the Germans print out maps showing how they learned from America this way, and they were concerned that they were behind the curve.
After the war, the popular thinking is that the eugenics movement, particularly the aspect of the eugenics movement that resulted in the Holocaust and in those pre-World War II sterilizations, is pretty much in decline. But I think your view is that things are a little more complicated than that after World War II. Isn't that right?
Well, a good deal more complicated. I think that there's obviously there was revulsion when the films of the liberation of the death camps came out in the 1940s. But I don't think very many people made any direct connection between things like American sterilization laws, or for that matter, the immigration or anti-miscegenation laws that stayed on the books in America until the 1960s, and the idea that those things were somehow reflected in a social policy that was part of Nazism.
Mm-hmm.
We had a clear revulsion against Hitler's excesses, but understanding the intellectual foundations for those things is something that didn't come until much, much later.
Mm-hmm. And many listeners were familiar, for example, with the so-called bell curve movement. You argue that there's a connection to the pre-World War II beginnings of eugenics in that movement as well. This notion that there are racial differences that are inherent and discernible with respect to IQ.
Yes, the biological determinism that is the basis, really, of the argument of the bell curve is in place by the 1920s. The person who is the first president of the group which advances that perspective even today, the Pioneer Fund, was Harry Laughlin, same man who got the Nazi honorary degree for his work in what the Nazis called the science of racial cleansing. So there are some clear historical connections between these very old ideas and contemporary directions as well.
I want to say that we're talking with Paul Lombardo, professor of law at Georgia State University, about his new book from Johns Hopkins University Press, Three Generations, No Imbeciles, subtitled Eugenics, the Supreme Court, and Buck v. Bell. Talk a little bit about contemporary ethics and genetics. Not as easy to make moral judgments, as you and I know, about what's going on right now, for example, in prenatal diagnosis and in family planning and so forth. And you, although you write with the careful, somewhat the scholarly pen of an historian, nonetheless, one senses your outrage, if I might say, in the pages of this book about the Buck case and its the consequences of the Buck case. But you're not as clear about the implications of Buck for all of the different work that is going on right now in genetics. Could you talk a little about that?
Yes, I think it's a much more difficult question to address. I try to address what I consider the clear issue of coercive surgery. I mean, the Buck case is the first time in the history of the United States in which the Supreme Court says that it's appropriate to operate on someone who doesn't need surgery
mm-hmm.
for purposes of state. Mm. This is eugenic statecraft in the operating room.
Yeah.
And I think that's outrageous. It was then. It was then not only because I think it violates some of the most cherished principles of bodily integrity that are embedded in our law, but also because the case was bogus. Carrie Buck turns out was raped. She wasn't just another unwed mother. Her lawyer essentially threw the case. So there's a lot of very nasty facts in the Buck case. It's to me much easier to talk about the ways in which we try to cling to old-fashioned eugenics today by continuing to try to sterilize people who are on welfare, for example. This comes up and regularly judges try to make this declaration to to deadbeat dads or
right.
to mothers who are on drugs and right. and that sort of thing goes on even today. And that's not like what happened in Buck. That's exactly what happened in Buck.
Interesting.
So to me, to make that parallel is not so hard. It's more difficult to say what things are like eugenics
mm-hmm.
And to try to make an analogy. There are some you know, there clearly are the notion of prenatal genetic diagnosis is something that raises the question, is this like eugenics? Some
mm-hmm.
people would say, well, of course it is. It's choosing in advance who should live and who should not be born.
Mm-hmm.
Others would say, well, it's not, because there's no heavy hand of the state here deciding who will be born or who will not be born.
Mm-hmm.
It's an individual choice. And so it's a much more nuanced discussion. It's no less controversial, I think, but
yeah.
But as a historian, it's easier for me to point out the parallels that are exact as opposed to those that are analogies.
And we've talked about class as a factor. Obviously, an old-fashioned sort of Platonic notion of race was more of a factor. The idea of race is much more ambiguous now than it was 50, 60 years ago.
Clearly, even though we know, if we look back at the history of that idea, that it
mm-hmm.
morphed over and over and over again, and
yeah.
in the 1900s, the things that we would consider ethnicity, like being Slovakian, for example, were
right.
considered race.
Yeah.
So today we have a very different perspective on what race means, I
mm-hmm.
think, than we did then.
I want to end by talking for a few minutes about the implications of all this for contemporary progressivism. You and I well know that the Buck case and the eugenic movement is taken by many conservative commentators as a very clear failure and warning for progressive policy. Talk about that for a couple of minutes. So what can progressives learn and from the story that you tell in Three Generations, No Imbeciles, and what are the implications for progressives in the 21st century?
Well, I think that the people from the conservative side would say that progressivism embodied the worst kind of reliance on science and
mm-hmm.
reliance on experts and elite professionals.
Yeah.
And I think to a certain extent, they're right.
Mm-hmm.
Buck was sold as the triumph of science. We could clean up the streets,
right.
get rid of all those loose women and those drunkards and those poor people
yeah.
if we just applied science through eugenics. So clearly that's a cautionary note that sounded, and it's not completely wrong. I think it goes overboard.
Mm-hmm.
I think it goes overboard significantly when people try to make very facile and sometimes really simple-minded connections between the ideas that fed into eugenics and current social issues. For example, there is a trend to attempt to link in a very facile way Darwinism, eugenics,
yes.
and then the current debate over abortion.
Yeah.
And the Nazi card is played pretty regularly there by people who want to argue against Darwinism, want to argue against eugenics, as they say, and I would disagree, but they say that the straightforwardly direct descendant of Darwinism.
Mm-hmm.
Eugenics is much more complex than that, and we could argue, you know, we could spend a lot of time talking about the progressive era and what it meant,
yeah.
but we might as well talk about the industrial movement that made automobiles on an assembly line, the efficiency movement of
mm-hmm.
people like Henry Ford was as much part of progressivism as was eugenics.
Indeed.
So I think that this argument of who gets to claim eugenics and what is it, what should it be remembered for, I think sometimes becomes too simplistically an argument about the good guys and the bad guys. What I try to explain in my book is that it's very difficult to sort out. There are some bad guys in my book, clearly,
mm-hmm.
But most of the people are trying to do what they think is the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Their motives are not always pure. Nobody's are.
Mm-hmm.
But they end up with a result that's terrible. And so the conclusion that I draw from that is that we need to be most suspicious, as good conservatives usually say they are,
mm-hmm.
of government. When
yeah.
government tries to tell us, who should have children and who should not.
Yeah. Well said. So we've been talking with Paul Lombardo, author of Three Generations, No Imbeciles. Lombardo is a professor of law at Georgia State University. The book is published by Johns Hopkins. Paul, thanks very much for joining us today.
And, thank you, Jonathan.
We'll look forward to having you on other occasions. Great, I'm sure you'll do very well with the book. It is a very compelling, and it has terrific relevance for anybody who wants to be informed about what's going on in American social policy and science policy today. My name is Jonathan Moreno. I'm the editor-in-chief of Science Progress from the Center for American Progress. Thanks for joining us, and we'll look forward to being with you again on another podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you.